Right? The Nebraska Court of Appeals is now in session. May all who come here be heard. This injustice is served by what we do.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Court of Appeals afternoon session on April 13, 2022. I'm Rico Bishop. I'm pleased to be joined by Judge Frankie Moore to my right and Judge David Arterburn to my left. So we have three cases this afternoon. We will begin with State versus Schaller. When I call your case again, I will repeat the name of the case and then appellant can approach. I would remind everybody that we are live streaming and recordings are being made. So if you have any confidential or sensitive information, please be mindful of that. So with that, we'll go ahead and proceed with State versus Schaller. Okay, again, State versus Schaller, appellant may approach.
Your Honors and Counsel, on behalf of Mr. Schaller, my name is Audrey Long, and I was the attorney asked to brief the appeals case for Mr. Schaller coming out of Sidney, Cheyenne County. In this case, Your Honors, Mr. Schaller, who is approximately 45, 46 years old, was accused of inappropriate touching of his stepdaughter. They had lived in Madison County for quite some time, had relocated to Cheyenne County for a couple of years, and eventually had made a disclosure to her cousin. And at that time, she also wanted to kind of relocate with her cousins and her aunts up in Mitchell, Nebraska. So there was some concern whether or not she had disclosed it in a proper way via Snapchat, and so that led to an investigation. The minor child was then interviewed forensically down in Cheyenne County. Other children of the household were also interviewed and to determine whether or not they'd seen anything, heard anything, etc. Eventually, Mr. Schaller had some contact with law enforcement as well as HHS on the basis of maybe having a dirty house and inappropriate touching. The facts show that Mr. Schaller confided in his clergyman to say, need some help, I'm not sure what's going on, I'm concerned about some guns, there was a small transaction. In between the time, the record's a little unclear because the clergyman said, I can't recall exactly what Mr. Schaller said to me. In the deposition, he said one thing, and at the trial and then the motion in limine on the 404 hearing, he said another. But in any event, the lower court ruled that the prior bad acts that were alleged from a sister could come in. The other children that were interviewed, the statements could not come in from Cash, I believe is his name, but that the statement allegedly made to the clergyman about, yeah, that probably happened or something to that effect could come in. Fast forward a little bit, there was an amended information filed by the state. It does not appear from the record that the state sought permission to do so, but it was there. It's believed that maybe there were some plea negotiations entertained. And then at the time they went to do that, Mr. Schaller changed his mind, then proceeded to trial. So the next issue that the court had to determine was that of whether or not the Second Amendment information was appropriate to be filed. And there was a small hearing in there about it.
Excuse me, counsel. Yes. The state did file a motion for leave to amend the second time.
The second time, yes, Your Honor.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
The first one, it does not appear that there was any motion. It's the second amended information. There was a motion. And a hearing was held on that, and defense counsel objected to it, saying, well, you've gone back to the original two charges, but now you've enlarged the time. And so I think that's inappropriate. If we're going to go back to the original charges, since we're not pleading, it should be as the original information. The court overruled that, and I think one of the concerns I have leading to one of my arguments on ineffective assistance of counsel was that the judge specifically asked defense counsel, does this prejudice you? I don't think that was his exact question, but the defense counsel said, no, we can proceed. And that was about a month later, they were ready to trial.
As to the dates, though, in the first information, there were two date ranges.
Correct.
But in the second amended, wasn't that just included all in one date range?
It did. And so the issue, one of the issues that I cite in the briefs, Your Honor, is that under the second amended information, under the first, the original information, for instance, you had January to June, you could kind of pinpoint maybe what's going on there, build your defense. And then you had June to December, for instance. In the second amended information was allowed, it was the same time frame for both counts. Mm-hmm. And there was two allegations of inappropriate touching. And the lower court found, well, based on a case, well, sometimes kids don't really know dates. It's hard for them to separate it. If they're not of sufficient age, we kind of enlarge it so it encompasses all these things.
But in this case, didn't the victim specifically testify that it was two separate incidences within a few weeks of each other?
Correct. And that's one of the issues that I raised on appeal, is that now we've broadened that time so the defense does not have an ability to create a defense. We don't know what we were doing. Because in the original information, it was limited to these two specific time frames. And that allows the defendant to prepare accordingly. When you enlarge it to include both, that is a double jeopardy issue, because now you're just saying this two times within these two things, the two counts.
On the other hand, it could be viewed as a benefit for your client, because you now have this very large window of time, which the prosecution would have a difficult time bringing other charges in that time frame, wouldn't they?
That is true, Your Honor. But I think that also ties into one of my issues with ineffective assistance. There was not a defense put on to any of those types of allegations. There was no questioning of that, specifically of the alleged victim or the other persons involved. And there was definitely no evidence presented directly by the defendant to try to dispute that or try to create those issues, that reasonable doubt.
Was there a deposition taken of the alleged victim?
Yes.
So did that, I mean, how does that play into this? I mean, you're talking about lack of preparation. At least if I'm understanding this correct, basically you had one period of time, a second period of time, which from the beginning of the first period to the end of the second period is the same period of time as what the second amended information charged. So the total parameter was unchanged. Is that, and maybe I'm off on that.
Your Honor, I could look real quick. I don't believe that's accurate, but I could be wrong with
that. So you think that it actually expanded it even further?
I believe so. And I could be wrong on those dates.
Yeah, it is correct, because it was 2018, September 2018 to December 2019, first offense, and then January 2020 through July 2020. So, and then when it was amended, it just said September 2018 to July 2020. It just combined those same exact two periods.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So yes, there was a deposition taken, and there were issues raised on the victim's credibility about what she did or didn't say and how many times her story had changed. Your Honor, before I run out of time, one of my biggest concerns is that of the prior bad acts that was allowed in this situation. I don't believe that the lower court did a sufficient job of balancing 403 4 and 414 with that of Valverde. And I kind of specifically give this court just a breakdown of the comparison in my brief so you can actually look at the facts. What it appears to me from the lower court at this point is, if we're going to say it's always an issue versus weight versus admissibility, then the way I see it is that anytime there's a defendant named and then there's a complainant over here, we're naturally going to be able to allow this because now it's an issue of weight versus admissibility. I realize that Valverde doesn't require specific similarities, or they don't have to be, 100% accurate. The issues we have in this case is that you have a complainant, the assailant being Mr. Schaller, and you have these two other alleged victims. There was so many other differences in there that I don't believe that should have come in. I realize the state makes an argument about, well, you didn't contest whether or not there was a probability of another crime or whether it was actually sexual assault. And you're right, we didn't, because we weren't there. It's unclear with the record what the court actually said. There was a couple comparisons, but I specifically remember the judge saying, I compared, therefore. And just a blanket statement doesn't actually show we made these specific findings of fact. And so when you look at the brief, Your Honors, with what we said the case were versus this young victim in this case versus the prior bad act, you literally had a female being in common, And that's about it.
And you're talking the sister. You're not talking about the prior acts with regard to the victim.
Correct. I'm talking the stepdaughter and the sister.
Yeah.
They're both females. That's about the most we have for similarities. The ages were different. The type was different. There was penetration versus touching. There was movement versus one that was described that way, the other way, where it was located, whether they were held down or pressured versus not.
And it happened 40 years ago.
It happened 40 years ago. I definitely think there's issues of credibility. And I understand credibility is always an issue. The concern I have is if we're going to actually use the balancing test that we're supposed to, we need to look at what similarities there are other than we've named an assailant and the complainants appear to be the same type of a person. And that, unfortunately, seems to be the going theme since Val Verde has come out. And again, I realize this court has said, you don't have to have exact similarities, but I think to protect the defendant and to help the judges ascertain whether or not prior bad acts can come in, we need something a little bit more than that. When you've got...
Let me ask you a question about that. The 40 years, I understand what you're saying. It's 40 years. It's a long time. You're talking about credibility, but of the prior issue, though, or the prior disclosure by the sister... but wasn't there also evidence that he admitted to his wife that had happened? And so, I mean, does that shore? I guess the first question is: does that shore up the credibility? And secondly, is credibility an issue for the finder of fact in the motion, much like it would be on a sufficiency of the evidence scenario? And you can go ahead and answer.
Okay, thank you, Your Honors. So when I'm talking about the credibility issue, I think, yes, it does play a factor into that. If you read what Ms. Boyson said, her reasons for doing this and why she was doing that, it definitely seemed fraught with a lot of motive and past anger. Although she said not, it all comes out as to why it is. When she's testifying to these things, how it happened, when it happened, why it happened is so different from what this current alleged victim has said. What I'm saying in that situation is the credibility as to what Ms. Boyson is trying to do and why she's trying to do it, because she specifically said, I don't want her to be in trouble. I want to be there for her, and therefore we've got 40 years where we can just make up a whole bunch of other things to shore up that if he did what he supposedly said he admitted to the sister, then we've got proof beyond a reasonable doubt that he had to have done it to this current victim. My issue with that is the defendant only said, I might have touched my sister, and that was it. There was no specifics given. There was not a time frame. There wasn't an explanation of how, when, where, why. But yet Ms. Boyson was able to come in and say all these very specific things in an effort to bolster the actual victim in this case's scenario. And if you actually look at the victim's case here, her story changed several times from what she said in the forensic interview to what she said in the pretrial depositions to what she said at the 414 hearing to then what she actually said in trial. And that's what I was trying to say is credibility is always an issue for both of them. But the motive behind what they said and how they said it is completely different, wherein Ms. Boyson's was, revenge, for lack of a better phrase, whereas this current victim appeared to be more just, this is kind of what happened. I don't really have the specifics. And her testimony, only her testimony, should have been allowed, not something from 40 years ago that, again, has no similarities other than they are both females.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
And I know we took her over at least a minute, so let's just add a minute to Ms. Osborne's time.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
May it please the court, my name is Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska, and...
Counsel, if you don't mind, while it's fresh in my mind, our mind, let's talk about the sister and the 403 issue that we just left off
and,
with.
You know, just to start right from off the bat, I would disagree that it's 40 years. I think if you do the math from 1987 to 2019, it's at most 32 years. And that might be parsing, but I do think that that is something that's relevant for the court to consider, the specific number of years. So appellant does assert that the district court abused its discretion. It's important that we recall here, this is an abuse of discretion standard. And we're talking about the appellant's sister's testimony for the 414. So after finding that there was clear and convincing evidence that the appellant committed the prior sexual offenses against the sister, the court then proceeded to the 403 factors. It found that the probability that the prior offenses occurred was high. And it also acknowledged that there existed this temporal distance between what happened to the sister and what has happened to this victim in this case. So citing the State versus Keeby, the court noted that in that case, several decades had passed between some of the prior incidents and what had happened to the current victim in that case, which is similar to what happened here, and that the Keeby court, the Nebraska Supreme Court here, found that the temporal remoteness was a matter of weight versus admissibility. That's not the trial court coming up with that language, this Nebraska Supreme Court.
But what about it, excluding the temporal distance, the similarities or lack of similarities between the alleged abuses?
Correct. That's the next thing that the court went into, is the similarities and differences. The court specifically listed out some similarities and differences, balanced those similarities and differences, and determined that any issue in terms of the fact that there were some differences between the two incidents was, again, a matter of weight versus admissibility. And so specifically, again, the Nebraska Supreme Court has stated that in Valverde that the appellant's prior sexual offenses are not required to be so similar as to be perfectly congruent for the evidence to be admissible at trial. And in this particular case, what is at issue is the 403, so the unfair prejudice balancing. Appellant focuses on the differences between the prior incident and the current sexual offenses and disregards a multitude of similarities. And so what are some of those similarities? Each victim was a female minor. They were of similar ages. We're talking about between 7 and 11 years old. Both victims endured multiple assaults over a period of time. That includes the current offense because it happened twice. All of the assaults occurred at a residence where the appellant and the victim were living together. The appellant had some type of authority over each of the victims. I think it's also similar that both victims were homeschooled and had not had an opportunity at having some type of sex education in a public school about what was appropriate touching and what was not, and it would have also limited their ability to disclose to a teacher or a friend at school.
And in this case, it was Mr. Schaller who proposed homeschooling the victim, isn't that
the
right?
The current victim, mm-hmm. Correct. And there was a familial or family-like relationship between both the appellant and both of the victims. You have a brother-sister relationship, and you have a stepfather-stepdaughter relationship. And here we also have victims being incapable of giving consent. So there's a multitude of similarities here. There's also reasons why there are some differences in terms of where the touching occurred. The sister was 7 years old, approximately, when this was occurring. The victim in the current case was 11, and that there's a dividing line of prepubescent versus postpubescent. A seven-year-old wouldn't have breasts for him to touch. So the fact that he's not touching the sister's breasts is because she didn't have any at 7 years old. But by this point in time, this victim has matured enough that she does have them, and that is what he has changed into touching. Previously, he had been touching the same victim the same way that he was touching his sister, by rubbing her vagina. So there are a significant number of similarities. This really is an abuse of discretion standard, and that standard hasn't been met here.
If we can talk about the weight versus the admissibility issue, you cited the case law on that and so forth. Is there, though, a point in time in a case where the weight is so low that it, I mean, we're talking about probative value versus prejudice.
Right.
So the weight is so low, it's so non-probative that then it is an admissibility issue?
There are, certainly would be cases where that could be the case. Here, I would disagree that, that's not what we have here. We have a finding by the court that the probability that this offense, these prior instances with the sister occurred was high, meaning that it's a very high probative value. So you already have a very high probative value for the evidence. And you also, I think it's important to remember, and it's been discussed previously, that the appellant admitted to his wife before they got married that he touched his little sister. And her words, her recollection of what he told her was down there, referring to her genital area. That is the exact description that the sister provides. That's corroborating evidence. It makes the probative value of that evidence that much higher.
And especially because it's so similar to the current victim's.
And that's an additional reason why that can contribute to the weight of that probative value being high. I think that the parties here disagree that I think appellant thinks that there's an enormous number of differences and not very many similarities, and I think the state disagrees with that.
It's kind of interesting because the similarities in the actual offensive behavior was where he was touching that the current victim, those charges weren't brought. I mean, those acts were not brought as offenses in this action. It was just when she moved to Sydney and his touching changed from touching her genital area to her breast, right? Those are the charges that were brought against him, not the prior touching.
Well, and the reason why that is because it's two different counties.
Right.
So they couldn't
bring
those other charges. And in fact, it's not in the record, but there was another case where those charges were brought in Madison County.
But Ms. Long's trying to create a distinction, right, that the sexual touching in this case, based on these charges, relate to him touching this victim's breast versus the prior experience with this same victim, which is not charged, was the vaginal area, like the sister.
Correct.
So the similarities are between those two victims in that way, but not necessarily to this offense.
That's correct. And the court was comparing the similarities and differences with what was charged in this case. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that the court's going outside of what's appropriate. It's making the proper similarities and a comparison of the similarities and differences with what was charged here. And of course, what was charged here is all that could be charged because that's all that happened in Cheyenne County. I'd like to point out a couple of things in Valverde. There's a couple of cases, Valverde and State versus Carter, that I think are useful in terms of this comparison, the similarities versus the differences. The Nebraska Supreme Court concluded in Valverde the evidence of other sexual assaults was admissible under 414. The ages of the victims vary between 12 and 14, so there's a range of ages. The assaults occurred at different locations. The nature of the assaults were different. Some of them involved penetration versus just sexual contact. And then in Carter, the victims were between the ages of 6 and 11, which is even wider than the age range we have here. All the victims were subject to multiple assaults. We have that here. All the assaults occurred at family residences, which we have here. All the victims had familial family relationship between the victim and the defendant. All the assaults occurred while the defendant was in control of the victims, and the victims were incapable of giving consent. It's all the same similarities that we have here, and those were found to be appropriate for 414. Unless there are any further questions on the 414, just very briefly, I'll address the double jeopardy issue. This is a new claim on appeal that was not raised below. The appellant even admits as much in the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. In St. versus Reinhart, Nebraska Supreme Court held that a constitutional issue not presented to or passed on by the trial court is not appropriate for appellate review. So this issue never being raised before the trial court, it's been waived. This court need not address it. And then as to the merits, I provided that in my brief. It doesn't meet any of the three double jeopardy criteria. There's no second prosecution. There's no double punishment for the same offense. So unless there are further questions, we'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Osborne. And Ms. Long, since we know we took you over, there's no time left. So thank you both. The matter is submitted.